quite
unusual.
Hello and welcome to the Quite Unusual podcast. This is an episode of Strange Encounters, a monthly show. I should have wrote this down, guys. I'm sorry.
It's in our Buzzsprout description.
This is the interview one where we do once a month and we interview a very cool person in the paranormal space. We are your hosts. I am Noelle.
I'm Nicole.
And we are here with special guest Darcy Stanforth. Hello, Darcy.
Hello, Darcy.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here. I've missed you too so much.
I've missed you so much.
We're so glad that you're here too. For everyone listening on Patreon or watching on Patreon, you're going to get the 17 minutes of us talking about putting soap in our eyes before we started recording.
We talked so much and we were like, maybe we should start the show.
We need to do that. So if anyone is unfamiliar with Darcy, first of all, how dare you? It's rude. Darcy Stanforth is an academic, a writer, a performer, and a paranormal investigator, an all-around slam piece. Mm. She has been interested in the paranormal since she was very young, and that interest has carried into both her personal and professional life. Darcy holds a BA, MA in America. I'm going to say that again. Darcy holds a B,
a BA, MA,
a BMMA.
Darcy holds a BA, MA in American Studies, and in addition to the paranormal, her research areas include race, ethnicity, gender, and sexuality, ideals, and institutions. And death and dying and grief in American culture and just so many more things. It's endless. It's endless ands. As an artist and performer, Darcy is a podcaster, comedian, writer, and amateur magician. What?
I didn't know that about you, Darcy.
We're going to talk about that in depth in a minute. She currently resides in a haunted house in Southern California. Darcy also runs what's the name of your show, Darcy? I just listened to it yesterday.
Mysteries Decoded.
Darcy is also the host and producer of Mysteries Decoded podcast, which is incredible, and I have begun binge listening to as of yesterday. So
fantastic.
Hi, Darcy. That was a very long introduction.
I didn't think you were going to read the whole bio. It's like, here's the bio. Here you go.
I think I should add
slam piece to my bio.
You definitely should.
Every bio. All around slam piece.
Yes. For those that do not know, Darcy, Nicole, and I, we're in a gang called the Slam Pieces.
Yes,
we are.
We also have recently started an a cappella group called the Do No Harmonizers.
And our thing is that we can't harmonize.
It's not a good a cappella group, but it does exist.
Never said we were good.
No.
Hey, transparency is a transference of power between people. So if you tell them, hey, we can't harmonize and they still show up, that's on them.
That's their fault at that point. We're not victim blaming.
No.
Yeah.
No.
But if you've been now, personally victimized by our lack of harmony, that's on you, babe. I'm sorry.
You texted me before we got on.
Oh, yes.
Do you want me to explain what a parsec is?
What is?
So I was in my room getting ready because for everyone that needs to know, I had to change my shirt twice because I'm so sweaty.
Our house is so hot. Yeah.
Why are you so nervous? It's us.
Also, our house is like 75 degrees. Sorry I did that to our family.
She did it.
I did do that. I was cold this morning. I didn't realize it. Anyways, so I'm in my room changing, and Nicole's listening to Dune in the other room, which I love.
I am.
We need to talk about Dune in 1 second.
Highly recommend the audiobook. It's great.
So good. It's so good. And I was singing to myself, we only have 20 Darceks, so we record with Darcy. Because I think a parsec is a measurement of time in the Star Trek world. And Darcy,
it's a measurement of time in general. It is a measurement.
Is it real?
It's about to get real nerdy. It is. It is a measurement of approximately 3.25 to 3.26 light years. And where most people would know it from would be Han Solo.
Star Trek. No.
Star
Wars.
The war.
That's the war one. Yeah.
I'm equal opportunity, but Star Wars, Han Solo talking about making the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs.
Mm.
So if anyone was like, is she nerdy? Yep.
Add that to the bio, too. Yeah. Slam piece and resident nerd.
All around nerd.
All of the toys in the background are not enough.
Oh, that is quite the collection you got behind you.
Yeah, that is a fraction of it. And at work, my office, our whole center is moving, and my new office is a little bit smaller. My first thought was, I don't know where all these toys are going to go. Not books, not academia, not my files.
Right.
Where will all my toys go?
It's the important part.
I mean, what is a toy but a file of the heart? Child?
Yes. Yes. Something. Yes. Let's go with that.
It's academic in a way, because right. You just dropped some hard knowledge on us.
Mm.
Now I know a parsec is real.
There you go.
Yeah. So that was I'm still going to call him Darsex, but
Darsex. I love it. I have my own measurement of time now, so I'm
you
excited.
Do. 525,600 Darsex.
That was actually a good harmony.
That was pretty good.
That was really good. You know what? See, that's how we keep them.
Yeah.
Is that like we do some bad harmonizing and then we actually harmonize and then they're like, wait, maybe it was a rough start. And then we go back to not harmonizing and then back in. Just, we just keep them guessing the entire show.
Gotta keep them on their toes.
Yeah. And maybe like our gimmick could be that we give everyone earplugs at the beginning of all of our concerts at their discretion if they want to use them or not.
You know, whatevs.
Whatevs.
Whatever. Whatever. So, Darcy, we have very little prepared for this because we're all best friends.
Awesome. We're just going to vibe.
I know.
Just gonna vibe.
For those of you that don't know, we met Darcy at Michigan Paracon last year,
which is in almost Canada, Michigan.
Yeah, it was an immediate, just like friendship. Also, too, we were like, "This is our person."
It was.
We love Darcy.
It was amazing. We made eye contact across the smokiest bar in the whole fucking world.
Yeah,
you want to talk about eyes burning,
right
in there? And it was like time slowed, and we skipped towards each other. In slow motion.
Slow motion.
And it was beautiful. And then we all collided. And that James Blunt song, Beautiful, was playing. It was amazing. And we were like, hi, I'm Nicole Noel. And you were like, that's a weird way to introduce yourself. I'm Darcy. And then we all were best friends. And then I proposed to you.
Yes, that's right.
That was the next day. I proposed to you the second day.
I photographed it. Mm-hmm.
And so many people were like, congratulations.
People thought it was real.
And I was like, wow, I'm really understanding who, if I didn't already know, is, you know, inclusive and welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
And other people, like people were just like, oh my gosh, I saw you get engaged. Like I got messages.
Did you?
Did you really?
Yeah. That's,
okay, now I'm offended because I didn't get messages.
People were serious. They're like, that I'm so excited for your engagement. I'm like, oh, so.
You're like, I have a husband.
He's real.
I have things to explain to you. Yeah. So, but I, you know what? I love it because some people who I was not aware of their stance on, you know,
now you know.
All the world.
Yeah.
I found out. So good.
It's like a good litmus test, actually. Like, are you an ally? Are you cool with this? I'm just going to propose to you. Guess what? That was a prank. Now we know where you stand.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
Boom.
Boom.
I mean, there's a haunted doll that was there that shall not be named that gave us some looks. And I was like, oh, excuse me, Annabelle. Okay, I'm fucking sorry. Whatever. Get back in your box then, girl.
Can I tell you, because you mentioned James Blunt, a story
regarding
James Blunt, which is very random.
Of course you have a story about James Blunt. You have a story about everyone.
Yeah, Darcy's the coolest person
Darcy
we have ever met
everyone.
In our lives. She knows everyone. She knows everything. And she's just like lived 1,000 lifetimes somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
I've had a lot of life which is great. Like I love it.
Wonderful.
And I love that I forget, like, oh, not everyone lives life such as this. And then people are like, what happened? I also have that photo that I sent you all a text of, just like handy, so we could show it to the
if
you want.
Yes.
But James Blunt, so my dad, back when he was one alive and two working, used to work down at the Navy base in San Diego. And he would stay down there during the week at this hotel off Hotel Circle, which is like where all the hotels are in San Diego, that are not downtown. And I get this call from him and he's like, and I'm not going to try and do my dad's accent. My dad was very English, very Yorkshire.
Oh,
and, but he was like, do you know a singer named Mark Blunt? And I was like, I don't. What? No, don't know. Don't know Mark Blunt. And he's like, there's a man here. I'm talking to him in the bar. His name is Mark Blunt. He says his songs are on the radio. And I'm just it's such a random conversation that nothing registers to me. I'm like, nope, dad, but cool. It's like, okay, because I was telling him about you, and I'm like, great.
That is such a dad thing. His songs are on the radio. I told him about my daughter.
Like, right?
Oh.
Classic dad.
Well, I have a daughter.
I got a follow-up one with that. Okay. Like, oh, even classicer dad. So then, like, I get off the phone with him. I'm just like, that was random, but that was my dad. Hmm. My dad would also be like, oh, I took a message for you. Okay. Who called? Mike? Which Mike? I don't know. Did you get a number? No. Cool. Okay.
He said it's urgent, though, so call him back.
Right.
As soon as you get this.
So months go by, and then we are somewhere, and James Blunt's Beautiful comes on. And my dad's like, yeah, that's that singer I was talking to.
Mark.
James Blunt.
No.
Oh, not Mark Blunt. So Mark Blunt. And so whenever I hear James Blunt, I'm like, oh yeah, Mark Blunt. The next level, my dad took this. Let me tell you about my daughter. And again, it's like one of those dad things that you just like, precious father. Oh. Back before I went into higher ed, I was looking to go into the nonprofit world, and I applied at what is now the Priority Center. Used to be called the Orange County Child Abuse Prevention Center, because they are a really great organization that I work with every year. And I told my dad this. So my dad took it upon himself to then write me a letter of recommendation.
Okay. Right.
That he then told me about later.
Okay.
I'm going to see if I can pull this up now for you, because I need to do it the pure justice.
Okay.
Okay.
What was your dad's name? What's his first name?
My dad's name was Alan.
Alan. Mm. Okay.
Alan Staniforth.
Okay.
Sweet Alan.
And
from Yorkshire.
Yeah. Here we go.
Okay.
Here it is. Just job reference. That's just what he says.
Okay.
My daughter, Darcy Staniforth, told me Friday that she had applied to the CAP Center, Child Abuse Prevention Center, for a job as assistant to the director. I can vouch to the fact that she knows a lot of people in show business, and she has put on several benefits to raise money. Darcy has participated in the Adopt a Family Project for several years, from her teens until the present. She is working in the retail jewelry field as of now, and has been for quite a while. She has had management experience working for Starbucks. I know she has to compete with other applicants, and I'm not asking for any special treatment, just a chance to interview. Just remember, I can vouch for the fact that she knows a lot of people in show business.
He did not say that again. He did.
He doubled down.
He's
on
name
the
dropping for you, but without any names.
He's like, and I am also very good friends with a Mr.
Just remember,
what was that celebrity I just met in the bar?
Mark Blunt.
Mark Blunt.
That's fucking
radio fame.
Mm-hmm. So that's like dad doing the dad. And, you know, it's like I couldn't. One, when he read that to me, he's like, oh, let me read you the letter I wrote you. One, I couldn't be mad.
No.
But right. I also simultaneously knew I'm not getting an interview for this job.
I was going to ask. I was like, did you get it?
No.
How could you not? Your dad wrote you a letter about you knowing celebrities.
But you know so many people in show business.
Times
two. I know so many people in show business, which is such like a 1940s, like, she knows people in showbiz.
It does have like an old timey, like, my daughter of showbiz knowing people fame. Like, okay.
That's great.
Yeah, you all would have loved my dad. He was a riot. But yeah, that was the job reference letter. Mark Blunt, and then the job reference letter. Aww.
That's such a... I love dad so much, man.
Well, speaking of jobs that you do have, you work at the Kellogg House.
I do.
She used to sell jewelry, though, according to that letter. So she was slinging necklaces, and now she's slinging ghost stories.
Slinging necklaces to slinging ghost stories.
Can
yes.
you tell us, I don't know, some, like, do you have any creepy experiences there? Because you do tours, right?
Yeah. So the Kellogg House is part of the Heritage Museum of Orange County, which is traditionally like an event venue and also does school tours for kids. Like, it's a hands-on learning museum. And so if you're in a school group and you go there, like, churn butter in a jar, you learn about Victorian life, things like that. So, and it's a fully restored Victorian house. It's cool. The Kellogg House is so stunning. Built in 1898 by Hiram Clay Kellogg for his second wife, Helen Kellogg.
Get you a man that builds you a house, ladies.
Right?
The bar needs to be right? higher for his second
yeah.
wife.
And she, yeah,
for
she
his second wife.
One.
Yeah.
Built her a house. Now, to be fair, that house is very much like there's so many touches of like his desire in that house, like as far mm-hmm. as like, I like this and I like, but still, he built her a house.
Yeah.
Stunning house. Two story. It had at originally basement and a beautiful open attic. Four bedroom plus like an office on each floor. Like it's stunning. It's gorgeous. I can't wait for you all to come out and I'm gonna
I know.
Take
We're going.
You on a tour.
We're coming.
So the Kellogg we have a number of spirits that seem to hang out in the Kellogg, including Helen Kellogg. And most recently, we think we've also figured out that Hiram also hangs out there.
Ooh.
And it's, I'm still kind of processing because I was on an investigation with Golden State Paranormal, which is, they're fantastic folks that I met because they came on my tour and they said, hey, we really want to do an investigation at the Kellogg. Can you be our guest?
Hell yeah.
Yep. Because I don't usually get to be there to investigate.
Right, yeah.
And so I had that chance just a couple weeks ago and it was a very active night at the house, like incredibly active. And that's when through some EVP stuff, we think that Hiram showed up.
Cool.
And it seems like Hiram showed up because of me.
He's looking for a third wife.
Well, it's we think he showed up because I reminded him of his first wife.
Oh, okay.
Can you tell us any more about that?
Yeah.
So his first wife, Victoria.
Great name.
Victoria Schultz. She passed only a few weeks after giving birth to their daughter, Sybil. And she had very dark hair and very strong eyebrows.
And that is you.
Even though with my Betty bangs, I don't look like the similarities there when you see the photo in the house. Mm-hmm. But if I like have my hair fully pulled back, it's like, oh,
really?
You're in that woman's family. So that's like a newer revelation. I'm still kind of processing.
Wow.
And, Martin and Steph are still going through the evidence from that night. And so I've heard some of it.
Yeah.
So the it's developing. Okay. So I'm like, okay. But you know, like that night we had flashlight experiments going off. We were getting EVPs all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those nights that if it's your first investigation and you think, oh, every investigation will be like this. Mm-hmm. No, they will not. Because when people talk about like, we sit around and then nothing happened. Like that is what happens most times. But between Bigfoot Collectors Club being with me only a few weeks before and then doing this with Golden State, activity on both nights, different types of activity, but also different equipment. So I don't know. It was really interesting. So that has been happening. I don't think I've had anything like the house doesn't creep me out. Like it's not a scary house. I feel really comfortable in there. I get ready for tour in there. So I change clothes and I'm, talking to everyone as I do.
Have you been back since you've brought out this? Oh, and has anything weird?
Did you hear like a wolf whistle happened? Last time you were changing?
you felt like someone grab your ass, but you turn around and no one's there.
Yeah. So I had a tour the following week after that investigation and Martin actually came back with me to just kind of, he wanted to debunk a couple things and then he came and hung out on the tour because he hadn't been on the tour in a year or so. And so when I was there and we were kind of setting up, I was sitting and waiting for him to set up some equipment. And then I could feel, I was standing in the doorway between the office and the dining room, and it felt like somebody was standing behind me again, but it didn't feel uncomfortable. It just felt comforting.
Oh.
And so, if this is Hiram, it felt very similar to the energy I had felt the week before, because it had felt like, when I thought, oh, someone's with us, felt like someone was putting like their shoulders on, or their hands on my shoulders, but kind of like this, like in a nice way, not in a, kind of way. And I felt that same energy. And we got some activity in the house before the tour.
Interesting.
And we did a couple things after the tour last time. So it, again, it doesn't feel creepy. It's just like, I feel like I have a new awareness of what's going on with him. But we've got, so Hiram and Helen seem to live in the house. And Hiram, to be fair, and it was like one of those, like, well, of course. Because Hiram died on Christmas Eve, Eve of 1921 from complications of ulcer surgery.
In the house?
No, at what we would consider now a hospital, but it was called the Anaheim Sanitarium.
Gotcha.
And so he, like, left the house expecting to come back to the house and didn't.
Yeah.
So that doesn't surprise me. But at the same time, the things that seem to be connected to me being in the house are, that's what I'm still processing. Like, it's because, maybe because I'm there. I don't want to be like, it's because of this slam piece in modern
that's
time.
That's fucking me.
But it is.
Do you know if they had like his funeral or like they brought his body back to the house? I know that was a common Victorian thing, so to like have a
because
viewing.
He passed in 1921. I don't know that they laid him out in the house.
Okay.
Because in his obituary, which is a very lengthy obituary, they talk about when the services will be, but they don't say where they'll be.
Oh, interesting.
And all of Helen, Hiram, Victoria, their daughter Sybil, and a lot of Hiram's family are interned at Anaheim Cemetery, which is an old historic cemetery. It's still active as far as like people can be buried there, but you have to be a resident of Anaheim.
Oh, okay.
But Victoria is buried in the park. So is Sybil. And then Helen and Hiram and some of Hiram's other family are interned in the community mausoleum there.
Oh.
And that mausoleum is not open to the public. It was built in 1911, 1914 in there.
Okay.
And so it was kind of the new modern thing. And Hiram tended to like being on the cutting edge of stuff. Cause even the Kellogg in 1898 had things like electricity, what they would consider air conditioning. And it had indoor plumbing, which was a very big deal for that time.
Yeah.
Cause you have to consider that most people didn't have indoor plumbing in the United States till the 1930s.
Yeah.
And if you were in a rural area, 1950s.
Yeah.
And I had someone on my tour recently who was like, oh, my grandparents in Texas didn't even get it till like 1968.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. So appreciate your bathrooms.
Right.
But so there, I don't know if he was laid out, but I could also see him. It makes sense to me that he might show up because of him, one, expecting to come back to the house, but also two, Victoria, his first wife, was considered the love of his life.
Aww.
And her monument is quite a testament to that as well. But him and Helen's marriage was considered a marriage of convenience.
Ooh.
Which, like, nobody wants their marriage described like that.
Girls got to eat, you know?
I mean, she did get a house, though.
So. But here's what I'm going to tell you. Like, Helen has definitely some stories around her that are challenging. But I really have to commend the bravery of this woman, because she met Hiram through letter writing.
Oh, the original dating app.
Yeah. Through a mistaken kind of thinking that she was writing to her father.
Oh.
And it was Hiram instead.
Interesting.
And he's like, why is this letter to your dad so sexy? What's going on here? I mean, I'm into it, but.
So that's how it is in their
family. It's a little weird, but.
So, and he finally fessed up that, like, oh, I'm not your dad. This is who I am. And so this woman gets on a train, like, he offers to marry her if she will get on a train and meet him in Portland.
Oh, wow.
Because that was the most direct route to the West Coast at the time. And he's like, I'll marry you on the spot and I will take you back down and we'll have a life.
I mean,
he could have been an awful, terrible person. He could have been horrendous. And so the fact that she got on that train,
yeah,
and I made a whole new life. And I was in Portland at the end of last year for the American Folklore Society conference. Mm-hmm. And I went, I have to go to the train station. Like I have to, right. I have to go be where Helen was,
yeah,
and Hiram was. And even though at the time she would have come in, the train station as it stands now would not have been there, but it is a beautiful mm-hmm. train station, brick and just stunning, like deco inspiration. And like, it's just a beautiful train station. But I don't think the train station wasn't built until a few years after they got together. Mm-hmm. But still to know that the train would have come in there, like that still would have been the stop.
Right.
Yeah.
Even though that station wasn't as what it is. And it just really hit me. Like I had to like sit in the gravity of that moment.
Yeah.
Because I really feel like part of, you know, working at the Kellogg is I feel a lot of responsibility to know this family and mm-hmm. to tell their stories in responsible ways.
Right. Do you feel like the more you get to know the family, the more activity seems to come out, like the more comfortable maybe the spirits and the ghosts are with you?
Yeah, I definitely think we saw that on the full investigation that I did with mm-hmm. Golden State mm-hmm. because so Martin and Steph are from New Zealand.
Oh, cool.
And so they have awesome New Zealand accents. Yeah. And there were times where they would talk to me over Martin and I didn't know if it was like, I was like, does Martin sound like he's just from New Zealand? Cause they right. might not know.
Yeah.
But there were definitely times when things were interacting with me, but they wouldn't interact with him. But that also could have been a gender thing. That's something I think about a lot yeah. in investigation, oh, yeah. Especially when it comes to child spirits.
Yeah, mm-hmm. for sure.
Because you might more interact with a female entity than a male entity right. and not to get trapped in that binary, but if they're of a certain time period, that's what they understand.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
So we've seen that, but I think when it comes to some of the other spirits like Helen, I think that the activity has changed. And here's why I think it has changed. So when I first came to the house, she was a little more, I don't want to say aggressive because I don't, it's not like, oh, you know, come at me, ghost. It's not
she
that.
Wasn't like scratching it you was, or like demonic.
She yeah, like... not, it's nothing like that. Mm-hmm. I think though that one, mm-hmm. because I look like Victoria, I think she was confused.
Mm. Yeah.
Two, I joke in my tour about Hiram, like how handsome he is, because he was a very handsome man and uh-huh. he had an incredible mustache. And I'm like, look at this man's mustache.
You can ride that all night for sure.
And so I don't know if she thought like, who is this woman in my house that's talking yeah, about my yeah. husband?
That's interesting.
But then we tell a pretty intense and violent story involving Helen and her stepdaughter, Sybil, Hiram's daughter from his first marriage on the tour mm-hmm. For reasons. And at first when I took over the tour, because they hadn't had tours since the lockdown, mm-hmm. I wasn't telling as many like cute stories about Helen. And so as a historian, as an investigator, I really think about what would it feel like to me mm-hmm. if decades after I died, a bunch of strangers came into a house and this woman came in and kept telling the story about like the worst thing I ever did.
Yeah. Right?
How would I react? And I don't think I'd react well if I was still there. And so once the narrative of these other stories came in mm-hmm. and me giving a little bit more context to that other story, the activity changed.
Oh, cool.
So she will still show up.
Yeah.
She showed up. It seemed like she showed up last week. But, you know, I think it's just different. I think it's different. Yeah. And there are some nights I will walk into the house and mm-hmm. get ready for a tour. And I absolutely am like, nothing's popping around tonight.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I don't feel it. And then there are other nights I walk in. I'm like, oh, hi, who's ever here? Hi, yeah. little ones. Hi, Helen. Hi, Hiram. And and one of the rules we have about the house is that we always say hello to Helen
yeah.
when we go into the house. And we always say goodbye to Helen before we leave the house. And that's not just, it's not a bit. Like we do that.
Yeah.
And I really stress with my guests, like we're in Helen's house. This yeah, is her house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because when people disrespect Helen, Helen makes herself very known.
Well, we talk about on the show a lot. And like, I know we personally feel this and I'm sure you will too, Darcy, there's a difference between being a paranormal investigator and being a paranormal instigator.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, unfortunately, a lot of the sensationalization of, like, the come at me ghosts, like, the himbos with the tight t-shirts that just want to fight ghosts. Yeah. Like, how did you die? Was it gruesome? Tell me about whatever.
Who we're referencing.
We're not referencing anyone specifically. Don't be ridiculous.
No.
But, you know, it's that, like, it's a...
Is it John Tenney? It's John Tenney.
Yeah, you know, yes, he loves a tight black t-shirt.
Tenney loves a tight black t-shirt.
It's unbelievable. I saw him once crush a dozen eggs in his bicep, and I was like, Tenney, those were for breakfast. He's unbelievable. So, yeah, that's definitely who we're talking about. But, you know, that's the difference between, like, when you approach someone just like a human being, because, like, all spirits, all ghosts are people or were people or are somewhere, somehow. Do you walk up to someone you don't know and be like, hey, I hate your fucking face, bitch? No, absolutely not.
You don't.
You're like, hi, how are you?
Scratch me in the back. I dare you.
Can you imagine walking up to a stranger at Costco and being like, hit me in the face right now if you're here.
If you're here. And he's like, I am here. I'm standing right in front of you.
Hit me in the face.
You're also yelling at me. Right. Yeah, I refer to that as brost hunting.
Yeah, that's good.
And
I love that.
So I'm not a fan of brost hunting by any means. But I also, like, I also know that there might be opportunities where I may be working with folks like that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's, for me, about keeping my integrity as an investigator and not an instigator. But I think it's also too, like, I'm trained in how to do research. I'm trained in historical artifacts and what you do with stuff and what you don't do with stuff. And I think that I was trying to explain to someone the other day who this paranormal aspect of historical spaces is very new to them. Mm-hmm. I said 90% of the investigators that you encounter or that want to come investigate a place are some of the most respectful. They're quiet.
Yeah.
They don't want to break things. They want to listen. They want to evidence, and they will sit in the dark for hours and pay you to do it.
A lot of sitting in silence and waiting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think that as we bring together, like, these historical aspects as well as these paranormal aspects, that level of respect, and as we are continuing to move forward and evolve, I think there's less and less room in the community for folks like that.
Agreed.
Because people are like, hey, let's not. And I also think, because of my training, because I teach a lot on trauma-informed practice, because I work with current and former foster youth as well at my other job, is, you know, you wouldn't walk up to anybody and ask, like, tell me about the worst thing that ever happened to you.
Right.
So why would I do that to somebody who might just be hanging around in another dimension? Like, I don't want to do that.
Right. It's that, like, aggressive approach. Like, obviously someone's going to behave aggressively back towards you if you just come in and immediately assault them with your words.
Right.
So,
or they're just not even going to talk to you at all and just be like, F you. I don't need to say anything to you.
Well, and I also think about cultural norms of the time and the place that you're investigating, because if, like, thinking about children, right? Child spirits. We're in a Victorian home, and two of the spirits we have are a little boy and a little girl. And that we feel. Again, I'm saying this as, like, fact. We all know that, like, in the parent, we can just put that, like,
no, this is disclaimer. No one's an expert. No one knows what's true and what's not true. This is the vibe that we're getting. And we trust Darcy. So
it seems that we have two little spirits in the house. We have a little girl and a little boy. The little boy seems to be about seven. Little girl, from some EVP work we were doing, seems to be 3 3/4, which melts my little
God.
Heart.
So
3 3/4. So cute. So
such a little kid thing to say too, like, I am 3 3/4.
It's such a kid thing, right? And then we also asked, can you say your ABCs up to G? And then they said G. So cute. So with that, they tend to stay upstairs a lot, and part of that is, like, the cultural expectation that children were to be seen and not heard, and that they would, like, they would oftentimes not eat with the family. They would eat upstairs in their room with, like, a nanny or someone like that. And so on the last investigation, I had to tell them, like, hey, it's okay for you to come downstairs. you can come downstairs, you can be with us, you're not in trouble. Mm-hmm. But also, I think that sometimes they will stick closer to female figures than they will to male
Makes
figures.
Sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or more female presenting folks mm-hmm. as well. They mm-hmm. tend to stay in that space. And another local haunted historical landmark that's right up the street from us is the Dr. Wilhelmina Howe Waffle House. And it is a beautiful old Victorian house. And she was the first female doctor in all of Santa Ana.
Wow.
Cool.
And I don't mean female like OBGYN. I mean, just like as she was a doctor. Female.
Yeah.
And in that house, whenever I go in there, there's always little kids playing. And in an investigation I did a couple years ago there before lockdown happened, the child spirits would come and interact with me mm-hmm. and another like teen that was on that investigation. But as soon as males would approach, they would stop. And so I also think about those kinds of things, or the idea of like some women not talking or interacting with male presenting folks because of the fact that they are like, well, that's not appropriate. I wouldn't be mm-hmm. talking to this person yeah. or only women of this, you know, of ill repute would do such a thing. So I think we have to take into those kinds of things as well, outside of just even the language that we use, because there are things that they don't like that we use all the time that they would be like, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like most Victorian ghosts, if you say, what's up? They're like, I don't know what you're saying to me.
I don't understand that.
No.
Yeah. So
you don't know what's up?
You have what's up? No.
What about the Budweiser frogs?
You know, it's weird. Just some, yeah, that's a really good point though, as far as like, you know, who was appropriate to interact with yeah. when they were alive yeah. at that point. And especially little kids. I mean, even now, like, we have definitely all had the experience where a little kid runs up to you in a grocery store and they're like, Mom! And you look down, they're like, ah, you're not my mom!
Uh-huh. Grabs your hand.
But because you're, like, a tall female, they're yeah. like, that's my mom, obviously.
Yeah.
So
I had that happen in the Vegas airport once. Oh. And I got all of a sudden my hands being held and I just turned and I was like, oh, hi.
You're like, ghost child or real child, huh?
And then they freaked out and I was like, I'm not trying to kidnap your child.
You're like, eh.
Hands up. Yeah. It's not me. So, yeah. So I have such a deep love for the Kellogg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the more and more that I investigate there, that I lead these tours, because I'm doing tours more than investigating. I mean, mm-hmm. I want to keep investigating, but, you know, I lead tours there all year. Like we Haunted OC, we run the tours all year long. I say every season is spooky season at Haunted OC. And so people are like, so like next Halloween, I'm like, or March, come in March, come right. in February. I am interested though, because I decided to run a tour at the Kellogg on Leap Day, the Ooh. 29th of February. So my hope is that will be just weird activity
yeah
in general,
because it's a weird
but there's day. Also nights too that I don't feel anything in the house, but guests do. Okay. They've seen things, they feel. I've had a couple guests, there were two of them, but they were not together. Mm-hmm. They felt they saw the little boy in the house. So we've had people be like, feel like a child has come to hold their leg.
That's cute.
I've seen a man on the stairs. We get smells sometimes,
full like body apparitions. Cool.
It's active. So, and they're very cool about being good about the haunted stuff. Cause some places are like, we don't really talk about the fact that we have ghosts.
Don't
like, you're missing out because people will pay.
Right.
Yes. Yes. All the people will pay many dollars per ghost.
So many dollars.
So many dollars.
So I know you've been a believer in the other for basically your entire life. Can you tell us what made you, like, your first paranormal or like your first experience that kind of made you say this is real?
I think that came before my experience, and that was that we have a family ghost story.
Ooh.
And so my mom has, to be fair, I've asked her about this a few times and I've heard a few different iterations. So if people have heard me on other things tell this and they go,
wait.
I thought it was, this is the latest iteration.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'll just say that.
Give it to us.
So my parents, when they were first together, went on a trip to England because my dad would do a lot of business in England, being from England.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they really, my mom really wanted to stay in a four-poster bed. She's like, I want to stay in a four-poster bed. And so my dad rented a room at this basically like turned castle, like mm-hmm. in England. That's the joy of going over to Europe, is that like, oh, you can stay in a castle.
Right.
Right. Everything's 500 years old for some reason.
Yeah. 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 Here you go. And so that night they go to sleep and my dad keeps getting woken up. Mm. And he is just like, what is going on in the room next door? And he keeps hearing fighting and banging, and my mom can't hear any of it. She goes, I'm going to go back to bed. Go to sleep.
Right.
And he is just, he keeps getting woke up, and he's getting mad. Ah, can't you hear this? Like, he's getting so upset. So the next morning, they go to check out. And my dad said, my mom, one of them said, you know, to the clerk, mm-hmm. what was happening next door? What was going on in the room next door? And the man said back to them, oh, they're early this year. I said, what's early this year?
Goosebumps.
These spirits normally don't show up until the spring, but it seems that they're early.
Huh.
And what happened many years ago is that the man that used to own the space had the surname Staniforth as well.
Oh, no way. And that's crazy.
He got the maid pregnant.
Salacious.
Scandal.
And then she confronted him. They got into a fight and he killed her and he fed her to the pigs.
Oh.
What? So it seems that they showed up because Staniforth brought in Staniforth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was like the, like, I knew that story as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
Like I've not, I feel like I've never not known that story in my life.
Cool.
As again, as far as I can remember, I'm sure I didn't like pop out on my birthday and they were like, by the way,
and but, you're like, I know
we must tell you.
Yeah. So it was, you know, getting like having that story, but then shows like In Search Of,
mm-hmm.
Unsolved Mysteries, mm-hmm. Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that we watched as a family. Yeah. So it wasn't just like, oh, I'm over here, you know, getting into paranormal stuff or high strangeness or weird things.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents always really encouraged that. And mm-hmm. my dad was a big believer in something else. He always felt like there was another realm. In fact, as he was getting ready to pass, his language around it was like, I'm going to go on my big journey. Like, I'm ready to go on this next adventure, my big journey.
Mm-hmm.
And he had agreements with a few of his friends who had passed before him that when they passed, they would come back to visit and deliver a message.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made that same pact with him before he passed. And he's definitely, he shows up all the time, which awesome. Is great.
That's awesome.
So I, you know, I grew up around those things. And then when I was in, you know, as a little kid, I was always nervous that aliens were going to get me. Cause I'd go from being really excited about UFO stuff to really freaked out about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's the uncanny valley of how so many extraterrestrials are depicted.
Yeah.
So it gets a little like, no. But then when it came to the paranormal, one of my first experiences that was really jarring, but I was also like, oh, these things are there contextually. Mm-hmm. It's what I understood at that time was I was at a friend's house spending the night, and she and I, you know, teenagers sleeping in the same bed. Here we are, teenage girls.
Yeah.
And woke up in her house, and there, you know, I'm in her bedroom, and there are two like hooded figures standing over the bed.
Oh, nice and fine.
Nope.
Just lightly. And so I woke her up, and I said, "Do you see that?" And she's like, "I do see that." And I was like,
"Okay, good.
Okay." And so then we just, because we were very engulfed and entrenched in the church world at the time, we just started praying and they went away.
Mm-hmm.
I've had other experiences with other people where it seems like dark stuff has shown up.
Mm.
And I think for me, the way that I explain that, that's more about them than it is about me.
Yeah.
But because I tend to feel stuff and be sensitive,
mm-hmm.
I always feel so weird being like, I'm a highly sensitive person. I'm an empath, because I feel like everyone in this world,
I know what you mean, right?
Is always just like, oh, don't you understand?
Right.
I'm I'm an empath.
I'm a psychic medium. I'm a medium. Empath level 17.
I never knew I was a medium until I ghost hunted once. And then I found out I was.
Yeah.
So, you know, and bless my, like, my therapist is even like, remember, you're a highly sensitive person and you're an empath. And I had to explain to her why in the paranormal world, that's a weird thing.
It's a buzzword.
Or not a weird thing, a common thing. Uh-huh. And she goes, really? And I'm like, oh, everybody and their mother is an empath. And I
literally, though. They're like, my mother taught me at a young age.
My grandmother also.
We are the witches you could not burn.
Absolutely. And so I have had, I've accepted this because it helps make sense of my world because I've always been extra sensitive. And then I'm always like, every once in a while, I'm just like, are you sure I'm not autistic? It's like, I really don't think you're autistic. And I'm like, TikTok tells me I am.
Well, first of all, according to TikTok, everyone is. So
I know.
I saw this thing on TikTok that's like, do you like animals? Do you braid your hair?
Did you chew your hair as a child?
Are you a girl? Do you know how to read a book? You might have autism. I'm like, fuck, guys, I have 100% of these symptoms. Also, I can totally relate to that because I started seeing a therapist because I'm like, I have schizophrenia. Period. Point blank. Right? I know for a fact that I have it because I'm seeing people in my house. I'm hearing people. I'm having dreams that come true. And no, I'm clear. So.
Yeah. See?
Yeah.
And this is the thing. So I think that I've always felt stuff.
Yeah.
And then until I got that language, I didn't understand that. But then I look back and I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It all kind of makes sense.
Oh, these things all make sense. And so. But it's outside of the paranormal, it's helped me in other spaces. Like I've been in spaces where like I'm out with friends. Like I remember once we were out at this karaoke bar that we would go to in our early 20s, you know, only 2 years ago. 22 years ago. But we were there one night and I just looked at my friends and said, we got to go. And they're like, why? I'm like, we need to get outside. And then somebody stabbed somebody else.
I just got goosebumps.
I also
and
have goosebumps.
So I read a room as soon as I am in it. And so I also tend to read spaces. And so I have to be very careful with that or else I can end up energetically hung over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And working with high trauma folks, I have to be really careful with that. So I'm not picking up other people's stuff.
Right.
But I think it helps. And I will be interested to see what happens when I do investigate places that have aggressive or dark energy and how that's going to feel.
Yeah. Well, 2024
I'm going to check it out, of course.
Obviously.
But
you got to.
Yeah. So
2024 is the year of setting boundaries, people. We are, whether this is a ghost or a real human being, we are saying this is what we're comfortable with. You shan't be crossing that line. Thank
you. Living and the dead. Boundaries with the living and the dead.
Living and dead, yes.
For real, though. So, all
right.
No, and it's true, because I don't want to, just like I would never want to put somebody in a situation that made them uncomfortable or push them to have internal or external harm. Like I wouldn't want anyone to do that for me either.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
For sure.
Darcy, I have to ask you about something because not to pivot away from
we're pivoting
from the paranormal. And so for those who listen to this podcast, we have this thing where we call our golden hot tub case.
Yeah.
And so for Noelle, that case is Heaven's Gate.
That's
she
Heaven's
did a fantastic, was a four part on that.
Thank you.
It was great.
I would join Heaven's Gate if it was, I would do that. So that's
would you get the haircut?
I think she would.
Yeah, I constantly talk about cutting
her hair
off.
Grows so fast, so it would just be long again in like a day. So
Marshall Applewhite would be pissed. He'd be like, come on, we just caught your hair. Right.
Oh my gosh.
But my golden hot tub case is the West Memphis 3. And you, my friend Darcy, were involved with a lot of things that happened with that case. So I have to ask, can you tell us just, I guess, like how you, what your involvement was.
Yeah.
And just all about that. Cause I'm so interested.
Again, I just want to reiterate for our listeners and viewers right now, Darcy knows and does everything.
Darcy is
somehow
the coolest person on the planet.
It's unbelievable. But like, Darcy, have you ever used a spork? She's like, okay, so me and the inventor of the spork, we're best friends. And this is how actually it was made. I helped do that. So mm-hmm. just like Darcy knows and has a story for everything. I mean, her dad knows Mark Blunt personally. So like she's clearly entrenched in.
She knows everyone.
Everyone. I know so many everyone. People in showbiz. Yeah. So this is, and this is going to fall right into that. So how I got involved with the West Memphis Three, mm-hmm. I'm going to let my dear fiance finish drinking.
I just had a vision of me spitting that wine out when you exactly. say this. So I was like, I got to hurry up.
So back in the early, like 2001, 2002, mm-hmm. I used to work for 213-61 Publications, which is the publishing house for Henry Rollins.
Of course.
And so I worked for Henry. And it sounds like a giant publishing house. There was like three of us that worked there. It was not in the 213-61 heyday, but I did work there. And Henry came home from tour and threw down copies of the first and second Paradise Lost documentaries by Bruce Sanofsky and Joe Berlinger, mm-hmm. and said, watch these, we're going to do something. That's literally what he said. Watch these, we're going to do something.
I love that.
Like, that's such okay. like a man. You better watch these, we're doing something.
And those documentaries are so well done, too.
Oh, Bruce and Joe are some of... Bruce has since passed away, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. The anniversary of his passing was just the other day, as a matter of fact. And Joe has gone on to do so much stuff that... Yeah. You and your listeners have probably all seen, like the Cecil Hotel documentary mm-hmm. that came out just a couple years. That's him, oh. right? He's been on all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And so Henry throws these documentaries down, and I stay late that night and I watch both of them. And as somebody who has always been an outsider most of my life, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I get this. These are nerdy metal kids. Like, I totally get this. And this is Satanic Panic. This is all Satanic Panic.
Yeah.
And so I get all fired up because I'm like, they're not guilty. There's no way they're guilty. Mm-hmm. And so the next day I get back to the office. I tell Henry, I want to do something. He says, well, I want to do an album. I said, great, do the album. But this is going to take, that's going to take too much time. What can we do right now? Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, do you want to do a benefit show? If you want to do a benefit show, I'll play it and we'll get other people to play it. I go, okay. So I start reaching out to the West Memphis 3 support group who you mm-hmm. see through those documentaries, mm-hmm. which is Burke Sahls, Kathy Grove, and Lisa Fancher. And I reach out to them. And, you know, I was so used to, like, because I was doing radio at that time as well. And I'm like, oh, these people might not want to have anything to do with this. And they were mm-hmm. so welcoming and awesome.
Cool.
So I started getting to know Burke and Kathy and Grove and Lisa really well. And I start putting together the first benefit, which was going to be at the Troubadour. Mm-hmm. And the Troubadour was like, we'll give you the space for free to do this benefit.
That's awesome.
And I was able to... contact folks from Henry's Rolodex. He's like, just start reaching out to people.
Right.
And so I reached out, like Pearl Jam's people sent us stuff. Tom Waits sent us stuff. Yes. Why is that record company?
You're like looking through the Rolodex right and you're like, who is James Blunt? Never heard of that one. Keep
I
going.
I was like, hold on one second. I'm like, okay. Epitaph Records. I was like, Epitaph gave us a bunch of stuff. And so people were donating for the silent auction, and we were going to do this benefit with the current incarnation of Rollins Band, which was the guys from Mother Superior, Jim, Jason, and Marcus, mm-hmm. and Henry being the Rollins part of Rollins Band. Mm-hmm. Then we had Exene Cervenka of X, her band at that time, the Original Sinners. And then Wayne Kramer of the MC5, his band, Ship of Fools. So we put this all together. Mm-hmm. The event sells out.
Yeah, awesome.
And the night before that this show is happening, I believe it was the Foo Fighters had played a show there. Mm-hmm. This comes in a moment, because as I'm standing, the way the Troubadour is it has this little bar in the front area. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the main showroom in the back. And all of a sudden, all of the music in the venue goes silent. And I was like, that's weird. Yeah. So then someone comes and they're like, hi, I got to talk to you for a second. I go, uh-huh. And I said, so the soundboard just blew. And we think it's from the show last night because they like rocked it out, but it blew the soundboard. We're going to call SIR, which is this place you rent like equipment from, mm-hmm. to see if they have another soundboard. But if not, we might have to cancel the show. I was what?
You can't cancel Live Aid.
I then go upstairs to the dressing rooms to talk to everyone. I said, hey, this is what's happening. This might happen. If we have to cancel, can you all come back? What days can you all come back? Because again, and I'm talking to Xene and Henry and Wayne and all the band folks. And they're all lovely. And they say, yeah, we can come back this date. And we can't get the soundboard fixed.
No.
So I have to go downstairs. People have flown in from Washington. They've flown in from out of state, like all these people. And I was like, hey, everybody, I have to get on stage. I was wearing these amazing red velvet pants.
Slay.
And a ruffly tuxedo shirt.
Slay.
I was doing fashion.
Giving Prince quotes. Realness.
And had to send like 500 people home.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
wow.
And say, please come back in a couple nights. Ugh. And not everyone could, but most people did. And those who could not come back did not take away, like didn't ask for refunds because they knew the cause it was going to.
Right.
And so that was the first benefit that I put on and worked to raise awareness. I was always talking to people about it, sharing, you know, the information whenever someone had a chance to do that. In fact, the skateboard deck that is behind me that I know you can see and your kids can see. That is, there was an art show, an incredible gallery that used to exist in LA called Six Space. And the art show raised funds. And I got this skateboard deck there with, you can see Jason, Jesse, and Damien all on there. Their mugshots are on there.
Oh, yeah.
But like at that art show, we had Jello Biafra, Winona Ryder. Cool. I believe that's also the night it is rumored that Tomi Maguire showed up and our door guy didn't understand who he was and like turned away.
Tobey Maguire got shot. Tobey Maguire showed up. Spider-Man fan. He's my Spider-Man.
Yeah. So, and Will Wheaton was there. Like, it was a great night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds cool.
And so it kind of became, I became friends with Burke and Kathy and Grove and Lisa. And so whenever like something would come up in the case, they would say, hey, we need to raise money for this. Can you do a thing? Mm-hmm. And so we ended up doing, I did two more comedy benefits. Cool. I did one at the Los Angeles, at the Hollywood Improv.
Yeah.
Patton Oswalt, Bob Odenkirk, Chris Hardwick and Mike Furman in their group Hard and Firm, which if you've not heard that comedy album, is just a glorious song album of hilarity. We had Greg Barron on that night. Fred Armisen was on that show. And then and also Laura Keitlinger. And then who closed out that show was Tenacious D.
Oh, yes.
Oh, and Blaine Kapach, the incredible Blaine Kapach, hosted the show for us. He emceed the show. So that was amazing. Mm-hmm. And I remember, like, at the time, Patton was helping me get folks, like, lined up. And he's like, hey, would you be okay if Tenacious D closed the show?
Oh, no. I don't think we want them here.
Right.
Like, what?
Absolutely.
Sure. So that was amazing. And then we ended up doing one at Largo. Mm-hmm. And the one at Largo, Mark Flanagan owns Largo. And Largo is one of my favorite venues in all of LA.
Yeah.
And Flanny is great. He's this big Irishman. He is lovely to listen to. He's also lovely to look at. and so Flanny was like, yeah, I'll give you Largo. No problem. And so like we had Blaine on that show, Patton on that show as well. Amy Mann and Michael Penn came and performed for us. Cool. Sarah Silverman, Kyle Kinane. Just amazing, incredible. Like, I'm just like, and then they're like, oh, do you want to open the show and like introduce everyone? I'm like, sure.
Yeah, casual.
So did that. But my favorite thing about that is because HBO was working on the third documentary at that time. Mm-hmm. Like, Joe and Bruce were working on it. and they had wanted to come to the show. Mm-hmm. The challenging part is like when you have documentarians come into a show, they take up a lot of space. And I said, hey, Flanny, HBO wants to come. And it wasn't like Bruce and Joe understood because it's like, hey, we're going to raise this money. Because they had been at the Hollywood Improv one. And so I said, HBO wants to come. And he's like, tell them no. He's like, we need to sell every seat. We only have 270 seats. Tell them no. I said, okay. So I had to tell them, I was like, hey, HBO, sorry you can't come.
Sorry, no. Hey, HBO, we're going to Tobey Maguire you off this list.
Yeah, totally Tobey Maguire them. Also, Matt Besser was on that that night. And Thomas Lennon and Robert Ben Grant came out as their characters from Reno 911. And it was so hilarious because they came out. And they're like, we got him. We got him.
Oh, my God.
Is it the right people? No.
Oh. We got him.
Like, they just mocked the hell out of it. It was so good. And so it was, that was February of 2011. And then that August, all of a sudden, I'm getting phone calls. And I'm like, guys, what's going on? They're like, things are happening. And basically, Damien's attorneys at that time were basically about to present new evidence that would have turned the entire case on its head. So then what the Arkansas, you know, what Arkansas then decides to do is offer them an Alford plea. And if people aren't familiar with an Alford plea, it is a plea that people can take basically saying like you're saying we have enough to convict you,
right?
But you don't have to admit your guilt,
right?
And so with the Alford plea, what they were able to get out, but they were still convicted,
yeah,
and they couldn't sue,
yeah.
And a lot of people
don't they also like kind of have to admit guilt with Alfred P. Alfred,
it's admitting guilt without having to admit guilt.
Right.
It's like just the, it's, and really it was the coward's way for Arkansas to get out of this.
Right. Of
because course. What Damien's attorneys had were like, it would have changed things. But the other thing they had to consider was they already got us when there wasn't evidence.
Right? Yeah.
Because for folks who are not, you know, familiar with the case, one, watch the documentaries on Max, like Paradise Lost 1, 2, and 3.
Unbelievable.
And then isn't there one that's like west of Memphis too, like after that?
Yeah, so there's the Peter Jackson documentary, and the Peter Jackson documentary uses a lot of things from the first three documentaries. And to me, like, I've seen it, I'm not anti Peter Jackson, but
Paradise
Peter
Lost,
Jackson
yeah for sure
came, and what I'm about to say sounds really crappy and I don't want it to, but Peter Jackson definitely came to the case later.
For sure, yeah.
I need people to understand how grassroots this was for so long.
Yeah.
This was people devoting their lives, their vacation time, their money. Like, this was such a grassroots effort.
Yeah, people who didn't even personally know the three of them either. It's just like they just knew that it was wrong and they needed to do something.
Right. And here's the thing. Burke, Kathy, Grove, and Lisa didn't know them personally either until they got involved in the case.
Right.
It's amazing.
They were doing movie poster art for it and then got involved. And so, you know, to me, I think Bruce and Joe's films are really just an incredible portrait of that entire time. And a lot of folks were like, you know, they should have waited, they should have done this. And as Burke put it, if you were in hell and somebody said you have a chance to get out of hell, you'd get out of hell.
Right.
Right.
And so the thing now that has been going around and the Innocence Project has been trying to work with is to get this new DNA testing done.
Oh, is that the testing? Is that the stuff that Damien's lawyer? Oh, okay. Because didn't they say that they like lost it or there was a fire?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're pulling like all of the excuses out.
And so this is a lot of the issues around the West Memphis 3 case, right? Because so there's... there's a few things I want to say. So one, in general, when this case was being handled, you have to remember that the West Memphis police were under state investigation because mm-hmm. there had been a really suspicious death of a deputy, and then a bunch of money and evidence had gone missing out of their like evidence lockers. So they were under investigation.
Okay. Interesting.
So when these triple murders happen, the state wants to come in, and the West Memphis, no, we're going to handle this. So they decide to handle this. Mm-hmm. Now, the night that the boys were missing before they had been found, a manager from a Bojangles chicken restaurant had called and said, there is a man, African-American man in my bathroom. He is wet. Mm-hmm. And can somebody come, you know, investigate this? So the police come, and while the manager's waiting for the police, goes in, that manager goes in the bathroom and finds a toilet paper roll. Like, so remember a toilet paper roll soaked through to the core with blood. Mm-hmm. And when the police come, they don't come. They come through the drive-thru. Is everything okay? And then the manager is like, I have this toilet roll though, full of blood. This is a thing. And they said, I'll just throw that away.
Cool. Okay. Good policing.
So there's that. Now, one of the things that I've seen that not everyone has seen and not everyone needs to see is I've seen the photos of the boys' bodies. I've seen the actual.
Yeah. Well, they show them pulling them out of the river too in the beginning of the first one, which is, I mean, it's
a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah.
And so there is, in one of the photos, and I don't remember which boy it is, but his hand is closed, and what is closed into his hand is a piece of fabric.
Oh.
And this piece of fabric was explained as, oh, that's just a piece of mortuary blanket that got caught in his hand.
Hmm. What? That closed around his fist?
You know, because a dead child
can
pull a piece of mortuary blanket off, right? And that piece of material again also disappears.
Convenient, of course.
Then you've got a lot, I mean, it's West Memphis, Arkansas. It's a lot of good old boys, a lot of satanic panic. You know, I will never forget Damien's father in the movie talking about, like, I never worried about someone wearing black because good people wear black. Johnny Cash wears black, right? So, like, black is not the scary thing. And if this case had happened, New York, Los Angeles, you know, larger metropolitan areas, it would not have had the same results. And when I talk to people about this case, people say, well, were they black? I said, no, but they were poor.
Yeah.
And so poverty and, you know, class and race, it's hard to separate, but like they were poor. Mm-hmm. They came from uneducated areas that really bought into satanic panic. And so many things that would get reported, and we see this happen today with journalism too, is that things would get reported, like they found bloody sticks in Damien's room. Mm-hmm. No, they found paint stirrers in Damien's room.
Right.
But like things like that didn't get retracted because people needed answers about who would murder three children, because it's horrific.
Yeah, they need to sensationalize things during a moral panic to make it seem you have to feed that fire.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the thing with, you know, these murders, and for us true crime girlies, we know that when it comes to crimes like this, these are usually personal crimes. Mm-hmm. And like to know that one, they didn't actually know, like the West Memphis Three and the three boys did not have a connection. Mm-hmm. On top of that, the West Memphis Three, none of them had cars.
Right.
And so to get over this massive highway into the Robin Hood Hills in this creek where the boys were found, they would have had to cross this huge highway. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about three teenage guys carrying the bodies of children across
unnoticed.
A busy highway and no one sees them, right? This is just not seen. But then the way they explained it is, oh, well, they lured them to the creek in the dark and then murdered them. And then they splashed up the water onto the banks and it washed away all the blood and all the evidence.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm sorry. Even like good serial killers don't get all the evidence.
No.
So, but some three just spur of the moment, we're going to murder people and we're going to like
teenage
so
boys
none of
too.
This case
yeah. Teenage boys
sense.
Notoriously the cleanest of all people in the world.
Cleanest of all people. Right. So this whole case from day one, like, makes no sense. Yeah. And the other, and this is where, for people who have watched, what is the, why can't I think of things right now? The Making a Serial Killer. What's the
Making a Murderer.
Thank you. I'm just like, ah, when I watched that doc series, I was like, this is so similar in so many ways to the coerced confession they got out of Jesse, because we have to remember that Jesse is developmentally disabled by our standards. He has an IQ of 70.
Right.
And they cornered him for hours and hours and hours and hours, stopped and started the tape, never had lawyers present, never had family present. And his confession is full of wrong information. And you can hear them feed him the information. It's like, oh, we tied him up with this. Well, don't you mean this? And there's they have alibis. Like, there's so many things. And then you go forward. And I can remember when the bite mark evidence, we're finally going to, like, test the bite mark evidence. None of the guys' teeth match, right? None of them match. The way they found the murder weapon, quote unquote, was Jason behind his house had a lake, and they found a rusty knife in the lake. They're like, here's the murder weapon. I mean, it's the wildest thing.
It's all ludicrous, honestly.
It's so ludicrous. And if that had happened modern day, I mean, it still was only in the 90s, but, like, with the level of social media we have, the coverage we have, I don't think this would have turned out the same.
Not at all.
And so you're talking about three men who are now men, right? Who spent 18 years in prison, who have come out, and who still have trouble making a living.
Of course.
Because they're convicted felons.
Right.
They're convicted murderers. And there are still, and this is wild to me, there are still people out in the world, we call them nons, that don't believe that they're innocent. And there's a book, Mara Leverett wrote an amazing book on the case. And I saw a gentleman, I don't know, 3 years after the three got out of jail, and he was reading it, and I was like, hey, what do you think of the case? And he's like, these guys are horrible, they're demons. And it was so weird to find, like, encounter a non in the world, because there is nothing tying them. And yet the people that have, you know, because if you watch the documentaries, a lot of people are like, oh, I think it might be Mark Byers. And people have a lot of strong feelings
or
about
Mark
Byers.
Or the stepdad. And
or the stepdad, which there's a lot of things around that. But Mark Byers, who went from being convinced that these three did it, came around and was like, no. There's other people, family members involved, who are like, no. And so this case, like, these three men need to be exonerated.
The West Memphis
Three needs to be exonerated. They need to be able to have their lives back. And there are so many just little details about this case. And, you know, I spent 11 years involved. And Kathy and Grove and Lisa and Burke spent longer than that. Like, they got involved, like, really early on. And the challenging part is that there's not the same kind of, because people feel like nobody's life is on the line, because, like, Damien is no longer on death row. I think that people don't think that there's an urgency about them needing to be exonerated, but they absolutely need to be exonerated, because they need to be able to move into other spaces. They need to be able to make a living and not struggle. And also not have to be re-traumatized by this constantly.
Even more so than, I mean, because most of us are believers that they are innocent. Like, I'm just going to put that out there. But just the fact that, like, they, like you said, are traumatized by this. They are convicted. They lost 18 years of their life. Like, everyone listening right now, think about from the moment you were born to the moment you turned 18. That is a long fucking time. And gone. Just poof. gone out of your life. You are living like an animal in a cage.
Yeah.
You do not know what the outside world is like. And then you are thrust into this space and you're still treated like a criminal.
Right. And yeah. Those 18 years, like, I mean, Damien even says in the documentaries that, like, it was horrific for him. Like, he was raped and beaten and all this different shit. So it's not like they had an easy 18 years of just being in prison.
No.
Either.
And that time was stolen from them by the state.
Yeah.
Right.
And I don't know. I personally have a lot of issues with the legal system, the justice system, if you can even fucking call it that in this country. But just the fact that, like, the government is still saying, like, well, yeah, they're out, but, like, that's enough, right? No, it's not enough. No. They need to have a clean slate. And honestly, they need monetary, like, reimbursement for all of that time as well, in my opinion.
Well, they can't because they took the Alford plea.
Which right. should also not be a thing.
That's the thing yeah. that drives us nuts about it, right? Yeah. Because mm-hmm. you have, I mean, I remember when they first got out and Jason was in LA and we were all having dinner mm-hmm. and everyone and Jason's like, yeah, I found out I'm allergic to shrimp because he'd never had shrimp in his whole life.
Yeah.
And then has shrimp, you know, yeah. and because again, you don't know what you don't know
yeah.
thinking about cell phones and social media and all of these things that like came about 18 years on the inside.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the damage that being in low-level lighting does, the damage mm-hmm. that a depression, like there's so many things about it.
Yeah.
And I see this with people that survive trauma in so many ways, as people love to talk about how resilient they are. Oh my gosh, they're so resilient. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to survive.
Yes. You have survival to be, mode.
Yeah. You have yeah. to survive. And so I would love nothing more mm-hmm. than to see them be able to live their lives as they would like to live it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, I think that our justice system can do some really incredible things, but I also For sure. have seen it do some really terrible things. And yeah. this is one of them.
Yeah.
And when, you know, this idea of like, oh, well, people have, you know, even with people that get out of jail for serving their sentence, mm-hmm. we don't have restorative justice in our country.
No.
Our country is not about restorative justice. Our country is about people can't change. Yeah. And if you're a criminal, you can't ever be you can't vote. You know, right. if you're convicted of certain things, can't vote, can't own a gun, all of these things. And it's like, because there is this idea of inherent bad, right? Mm. And this is where part of the challenge, this is where I enjoy the Puritans a little bit. This yeah. is where my American studies brain is going to come out, because the Puritans all felt that everyone was born into sin. So yeah. it's like, of course you were going to mess up because you're already sinful. So don't like, try not to be a jerk. Try not to be awful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But when the Enlightenment period comes around and we do away with that, like, we're not going to say people are born into sinful nature. Everyone's born so good and pure and proper. Then when people behave outside of pure and good and proper, you have nowhere to go.
How dare you?
How yeah. dare you? Right?
Yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so with, you know, and I have a love for all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jason is one of my favorite people on earth.
Yeah.
Like, he is just a kind, amazing person.
Yeah.
And he is the person I've spent the most time with. Jesse and I have never formally met. Damien mm-hmm. and I have, and Jason and I have, and Jason and I have a friendship that is still existing to this day. And like, he just wants to have a life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about like celebrity and this and that. And that was the other challenging thing too, because, you know, and not to get into all like the, you know, behind the scenes politics of things, but Damien had a lot of support from celebrities
yeah.
when he got out, and not everyone had that.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that, and that, but that also like lasts for a time.
Yeah.
And then what?
And then he had to figure out what the hell he was going to do, you know?
Right.
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 Yeah. So these documentaries were dropped off, and then you watch them and it radicalized you into, and you did some incredible work for these people. And
Thanks.
That's amazing. Yeah. And your stories are amazing. And what you do is amazing. And your research is amazing. And I can't say enough amazing things about you because you are amazing.
And that's why we're engaged.
Obviously, duh.
When's the wedding?
Love of my life. I don't know. Let's talk to her. Let's talk to Sean. Well, so question. I have just to change gears here. We ask everyone this, and this is something very important that I need to know because I think it tells a lot about a person, Darcy.
Okay. Okay. I'm excited.
If you could choose the last meal you ever eat in your life, what would that be? You have to choose a drink also. That's very important.
Okay. Mm. The last meal that I would ever eat, and this is going to be a mixture of things.
As it should be.
And to my vegan friends, I would like to apologize for one of the things I'm going to say, but I would do this. I would want to have my father's Yorkshire pudding with gravy and mint sauce.
Mm. Got to.
Just very homey and cozy and like growing up. That is part of my Englishness, my very Englishness. So my father's Yorkshire pudding with gravy and mint sauce. Then I would love my mom's baby back ribs.
Okay.
Because I could go a little T-Rex on them.
Got to.
And her corn pudding that she makes.
Oh, like love this a cheesy corn pudding.
Mm. That is amazing. I would also like to have a really amazing slice of New York style pepperoni pizza.
Just
a fold.
I was going to say that's a foldy.
Foldy eat. And then to drink an ice cold Mexican Coke.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yum.
And then the sticky crispy toffee pudding from Ye Olde Chip as the dessert.
Well, you have to have a dessert, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. You need a dessert.
Obviously.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That's a good meal, dude.
I think that I am a food person. I love food. I love eating. I love cooking.
Yeah.
And even though I am not vegetarian or vegan, I really try and take care of my vegetarian and vegan friends and make sure that if I'm cooking for them or if they're coming to town, that I know the good places to go.
Yeah.
But yeah, I am very motivated by food. Like I tell people, I don't get hangry, I get anxious.
Oh,
like when am I gonna eat next? So it's like, I'm a little anxious right now. Yeah. So.
I mean, one of the best parts of being alive is food. Like, let's be honest.
Yeah.
It's
you
ever eat a Krispy Kreme? That alone is like, I'm staying.
You know,
And that's the lowest of the bar for food. So
like but I also think about something like a really good piece of like buttered toast. Like just a beautiful, like, great sourdough.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, like, the perfect amount of salty butter.
Yes.
But also, I love butter, so.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't? Do you guys want to hear something I've never said out loud on the podcast
before?
Yes, please.
That I don't know
please.
If I've ever told you either, Nicole.
Hmm.
When I was a child, I'm talking, like, 7 and under, I used to take bites out of sticks of salty
butter. My little
butter.
Brother did that, too.
I did that, too!
Did you? My little brother did, yeah. I think that's, like, a kid thing.
So
thing. I did that too. Oh, yeah. It was, I would have had a hard time in rationing during the war.
Oh, yeah. No way.
Right.
No way.
I was really convinced that's why my dad had such a sweet tooth because of the years of rationing in World War II.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Because he was just like, okay, let me have all the sugar. My mom's not really a sweet tooth person. My dad was like, dessert, right? And my mom's like, what? Huh?
Yeah. I feel that all of my teeth are sweet teeth. So.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, Darcy, this has been such a fantastic time. And I honestly could talk to you about the West Memphis 3 case for like 17 hours, but have to cut
when
it short.
When you finally decide to do it.
Yeah. I kind of want to wait until if they test the DNA, when they test the DNA. Like, I'm holding out for that. Like, I need it. Because also a big part of that case is, like, the murders were so horrific. It's like, who did it? Like, who?
Yeah.
You know? And I don't know if we'll ever know, but.
And that's, like, the tough thing, because it's an injustice not just for Damian, Jesse, and Jason.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's an injustice for
the families,
Stevie, Christopher, and Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you still have 3 young boys that were murdered.
Right.
Right. And nobody has truly been held accountable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that, yeah. So we can talk about that. Yeah. Also, always feel free to like hit me up to be like, hi, we're doing this. Do you know anything about this? Because I have a lot of weird facts in here.
We will.
We'll credit you like in our sources, Darcy.
But I do want to show, because I've already sent this to you all, but I want to show.
Oh my God,
Pates,
yes, please.
Oh, yeah.
This photo. Since you all talk about how many Danny yeah. DeVito's tall, and we decided I am what, 1 1/4 Danny DeVito's
tall? 1 1/4 Danny DeVito's.
1 1/4 Danny DeVito's tall. Yeah. Just like that child is 3 3/4 years old. You are 1 1/4 Danny DeVito's tall.
Yes, I love it. I love, that's a great way to end this episode. We got really heavy and now we're bringing it back to Danny DeVito.
Obviously, he always shows up somehow. Always.
Got to.
Yeah.
Got to. Well, Darcy, thank you so much. You. We will share all of Darcy's social medias in the show notes. And then, of course, check her out on Mysteries Decoded. And if you're local or if you want to be, you know, make the trek to the Kellogg House, please go see our beautiful Darcy give a tour.
Thanks, everybody.
All right.
And as always, remember to celebrate the strange
and keep it unusual. Bye.